Repressive governments can restrict where you go, who you associate with, what you're allowed to own, how you spend your time, even how you dress. When breaking the rules might get you or your family killed, you probably make a show of obedience. But it is possible, not easy, but possible, to keep a brutal regime from controlling what is in your heart. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest calls herself Sola Mahfouz. It's actually a pseudonym she uses to protect her family back in Afghanistan, a place she escaped after years of on-again, off-again repression that kept her mostly housebound after the age of 11, when men who may have been members or supporters of the Taliban told her father that if she or her sisters did not quit going to school, they would have acid thrown in their faces. The short version of the story is that Mahfouz now works as a quantum computing researcher in the United States, which is to say she did not stop learning even after she was denied a formal education. But the longer version of the story is so compelling, we've invited her here to tell it herself. Her memoir, written with Malena Kapoor, is called Defiant Dreams, the journey of an Afghan girl who risked everything for education. Sola, welcome to Think.
Thanks for having me.
The story of your drive for education and how hard you worked to learn everything you wanted to learn is really interesting because as a young child, you didn't really like school very much at all.
Yes. When I was 16 years old, I did not know how to add and subtract. And that was because, as you mentioned, you know, I was 11 years old. A group of men came to our door and threatened us if I continued going to school. And from that day on, the restriction on my life continued to increase. I left home only a couple of times a year. And whenever I did, I had to wear this suffocating burqa that covered me from head to toe. And meanwhile, my brothers were going to school. They were thriving academically. And like 2 years later, 2 or 3 years later, I began to feel really jealous of their lives. They seemed to be moving forward. And my life was, meanwhile, remained stuck. But, you know, I was lucky to have a grandfather who was self-taught. And, you know, at that time, I felt, you know, everything around me stopped making sense. And I just felt that I was in the dark. And my grandfather used to say that, you know, if you learn or if you know English, it's like opening a window to the world. And in those times, I just felt like I really need this window to be open. I need this light to get in. And that's when I start learning English. And so Defiant Dreams tells the stories of how I went from that, you know, age 16, not knowing how to add, subtract, now being at Tufts University, developing quantum algorithms.
Your parents, of course, were shaped by the Pashtun culture they grew up in, that you grew up in, but your father was not entirely opposed to freedom for women and girls. How did his own childhood influence his view of women and what they were capable of?
So it's a very important point that Afghanistan wasn't like that as we see it today. And my father grew up at the time where, you know, liberalization was happening, you know, schools were opening for the girls. My father grew up with a mother who was very independent. All of his sisters went to school, and then, you know, all of them are professionals. They went to Russia to study for university, and my father himself, you know, had a university education. And so I think that's what and he lived most of his life in Kabul. And so I think it's just the time he grew up was opening up, and there was no such a thing as, you know, you're a woman, you can't do this. So that has deeply and profoundly shaped who he is today.
Your mother also had a university education and was a teacher for a time at Kabul University.
True, yeah. And the same thing, you know, my grandfather, my mom's father, was one of the person who was leading this new, you know, this vision for the new Afghanistan, you know, in the 1960s. And, you know, he never had a son, but he never differentiated between the daughters. And so he educated his daughters. And, you know, my mom, she was never believed that, you know, she's a woman. He told her not to do the chores, just focus on her education and what she can become. And so you know, though she grew up in Kandahar, but then she alone traveled to Kabul, finished her university there, and become a lecturer at Kabul University.
When she did get married, she struggled a little bit at first because she hadn't been taught to do any household chores and she was expected to do those things.
Yeah, I think that was a little bit, I think for my grandfather, he just felt like just because he thinks the society has changed. You know, it's like you change, but that doesn't mean the society has changed around you. Even if you are educate your daughter to that level, you know, where she could be a professor in a university, she still, you know, the society hasn't evolved that much to, you know, to say, well, okay, you can do that, then you don't have to do that. So I think that's, that was the problem there.
There was so much back and forth in terms of freedom during your parents' young adult years. Talk about how the Soviet invasion in 1979 changed the climate at Kabul University and then how the country changed again after the Soviets left.
So I think I think there was always the society, there was already some opposition to the liberalization that was happening, you know, women in skirts or, you know, just the conservative parts were opposing that. But it didn't made itself felt until the Soviets came in. And that's, because it became more like the Cold War politics, the U.S. poured money to those groups that were opposing those New Afghanistan. And that's when, you know, it was beginning to feel that those freedoms can be taken away. And those groups that were initially just small opposition became coalesced into what they call themselves Mujahideen, the Holy Warriors. And I think it was because of the world politics that influenced their strength.
You remind us in the book that many residents of Kandahar hadn't really heard of the Taliban until 1994, a couple of years before you were born. How did the Taliban initially present itself as just a virtuous alternative to the kind of wild behavior of the Mujahideen?
Yeah, so I mean, that's after the Soviets left, you know, all those groups that were fighting against the Soviets began to fight against, on the ethnic lines or the tribes. And then so that's when the civil war began. And it was just a complete chaos. And, you know, just the whole Kabul that was once, you know, had universities, a flourishing life just crumbled and everything was, it was just ruined. And in Kandahar too, there was this, you know, rockets, you know, one warlords firing rocket against the other. And so the Taliban became this unified force that would just wanted to get rid of those corruptions and this, you know, the evil that was just around every corner.
They started cracking down on all kinds of freedom, though, especially for women. You tell this story of women getting even in trouble for gathering in a private home and spending time together and laughing loud enough with one another for passersby to hear on the street.
Yes, I mean, they did brought security, but with those security and peace, they brought suffocating restriction that just, you were not even free in your own home. This is a story of my mom's relatives that they were, you know, just wearing the wrong type of burqa and just smiling with each other. Just maybe just they saw something on the street, and that's just, you can't just stop yourself every second, remind yourself that you can't laugh. And then they just laugh, and then they were pursued. And that life in those years was extremely dark and restricting.
How did the arrival of U.S. troops maybe initially make things look better for Afghan women who had been repressed by the Taliban? And then maybe what did you realize wasn't going to be better?
So I think when initially they came, obviously, this just felt like, those years the Taliban were in power, it just felt like the space was just shrinking. And then when the U.S., you know, this is, I was young, and so I have those memories of that time when I came, you know, we suddenly had TV. We didn't have TV back then. And also on the streets, and there was like different type of snacks. And so also, I mean, the schools were opened for girls. Before then, my mom would used to like teach us the basics, but then the school suddenly opened, and it just felt like the whole world opened to us. You know, I remember, you know, the word like freedom, democracy, and you know, there's the first woman who, like, a woman elected herself to become a president. And of course, in again in Kandahar, things didn't change a lot for women. Obviously, it was better than the Taliban, but it never became to the point when my mom was young. And though things had changed in Kabul and the bigger cities, Kabul, Herat, but not much in Kandahar.
What do you know about the day those men came to your family compound and told your father that you and your sisters would be attacked if you continued going to school?
I mean, I just have a fuzzy memory because, you know, most of the time, you know, when the door knocks, it's like the men go out. It's in the night. And so that's when my father went, and then they came back. He came back and told us that we are not allowed to school anymore. And, you know, I was allowed to go to school. It was not an intellectually nurturing environment. You know, the teachers themselves were not educated. Again, it's like all the years of civil war, and then the Taliban rule, all the educated left the country. And so those teachers didn't care about our education, and they often beaten us. And, you know, when I stopped going to school, when that night, my first reaction with that was that of a relief, because I just hated school. But of course, my mom, who, you know, was educated and who saw, you know, one generation of her kids not going to school. And that was would always tell us, like, it was one of the hardest thing that she would just think about her children, you know, with what dreams she had for them. And suddenly they were not going to school. And so when the school opened, this other generation of her kids, she had hopes and dreams that, you know, this generation will be educated. But again, those hopes were just trampled. And she would often say, like, do you know how it feels for an educated mother to see her children's growing up uneducated?
Meanwhile, your brothers were able to keep going to school, and all along, better schools had been available to them to begin with.
Yes, so there were like private schools that at that time were just for men, for boys. And so, you know, education was very valued in my family. And, you know, they just kept going.
So you were miserable for a while. You were not able to leave the house very often. There was a time when you thought maybe you would feel better if you were just a better Muslim and you tried to build this better relationship with God. Did that work for you?
I mean, I think I felt like the world was so dark around me. Like, I was very curious now that I reflect back. And I was very curious, I mean, like, why this has happened this way? Why is this happening? Like, why, you know, there was this understanding around, there was this general understanding, you know, women are just stupid, and that's why they're in this, you know, they're always at home. You know, I would see men all the time talk about politics and the world, and women most of the time at home, like, just talk about their clothes and everything. And so I tried to understand, like, what is this thing? And then I think that's what led me to, you know, I felt like maybe I have a better grip for religion understanding. I might be able to see, but that didn't give me what I was looking for.
Sola, you had learned a little English early in your school career, and then you had this break. What inspired you to go back to it on your own once school wasn't available to you at all?
I think it was actually my grandfather who had this sacred relationship with learning. And, you know, I would think about, well, if he, like, you know, he grew up poor, and he, you know, my mom told me, like, would tell me that he would walk on the street, and if he saw, like, you know, newspaper or like a plain paper, he would bring it at home and write on that. So I think I was like, if he could do it at that time, why can't I do it now? You know, I have, you know, I do have access to some, like, compared to him, I'm better off. So I think that's what you know, again, his words were so powerful that said, you know, it's like, you know, knowing English is like an opening a window to the world. And so that's when and then I felt like maybe that would allow me to understand, you know, my life, the world around me. You know, it just, I think that was the initial start.
And you ended up studying all the time, like your siblings and other relatives would be watching TV or talking or doing different things. You really threw yourself into studying.
I think this was, you know, as you mentioned, you know, I obsessed with religion, with fashion. It just didn't give me what I wanted. And once I started learning, I just, you know, I was dependent on my life on everyone else. And so when I started learning English, the first thing was I was able to do it. So that itself was it kind of felt like a magic. And then I think it gave me a purpose. And, you know, it's like the more you learn, the more there is to learn. And I just felt like it's so empowering, as if I'm building like a castle or something for myself. Even though it's just in my head, but I think it was this very empowering feeling that came, and it still does. Whenever I learn, it does give me that feeling.
It was fortunate that you started with English, because when your brother brought home a bunch of magazines in English, you picked one up, a Time magazine, that had an article about Sal Khan and the Khan Academy. What did you learn in that article?
Yeah, so, you know, at that time, I would initially, when I was learning English, like I would watch for hours and hours of BBC, CNN, and I would understand a word or two. But later on, I was able to pick it up. But again, it was all the time news. And, you know, already, you know, the Afghanistan, the political situation was deteriorating. There was suicide bombing exploding. And so I was always depressing news. And so So my brother was traveling to Pakistan, and then I asked him, like, can you just bring me anything that's in English and that's not all news? And so he brought me a lot of books, but one of them was a Time magazine. And as I was flipping through the pages, you know, I come across Sal Khan's profile, and it was about Khan Academy. And it was like, learn anything, anywhere for free. And it's all those subjects. And it just immediately I felt like this is what I wanted. And so I logged in, and initially my reaction was I saw an advertisement for algebra, and I knew like math was algebra was this high up thing. That was the only thing I knew. And initially I felt like maybe this is not for me. And so I closed the laptop, but after a few days I tried, was like, okay, maybe I should try it again. And then I asked my brother, you know, I was like, what does come after addition and subtraction? And he told me it's fraction. And so I searched fraction and I saw it was there. And it's like from that day, I started learning fraction, but I had to go back to learn my addition and subtraction. And that's how my education journey started, with the science and math.
Math is challenging for a lot of people, especially to learn without a teacher. What amazes me is that you were able to power through even when it was very difficult.
I think for me, it was not, you know, first of all, I think math didn't require too much English, because I was learning English at that time. And I think it's just like so clear on rules, like, you know, it's clear. And I think the social world that I was trying to understand was so unclear, that the one thing that was clear, I didn't find it hard. I found the social world harder.
Given how dangerous it was for you to even leave your house because of the violence, it's remarkable that you dared to want more for yourself. Can you remember when you started thinking about the possibility that all the things you were teaching yourself could secure you a place in a university somewhere?
So, you know, I had, my sister was lives in England. And when I started learning, she was telling me, you know, my brother at the time, one of my brother also went to England. And so I was like, I want to do that. And he took the exams, and, you know, I was naive enough that I might also be able to do it, because I didn't go to university. And I think that helped me, because I didn't give up. And so that's when I was like, well, if he did that, if I just do that, then I will be able to. Of course, I had to face hundreds of other challenges. You know, I didn't go to school. So when after like in 3 years, you know, after I start Khan Academy, in 3 years, I will able to take calculus and physics. And, you know, I was also studying philosophy. And this was that time I realized I want to study physics because it's just, you know, everything that I want to try to understand about the world, you know, it was in physics. And so I was like, okay, now the first step is like you have to have a high school diploma. And I didn't have that. And so I was like, okay, maybe if I go to an education ministry in Kandahar, they might give me an exam. And I knew that I know things. So I will just, you know, they will just give me based on that. But when I went there, I was just, you know, that person just didn't even look me in the eyes and just said to me, you know, we can't do it because, you know, it will be the other girls, the other are going to school and despite all the danger. And so if we just give it to you, that would be a disservice to them. And so they just didn't give me the exam. And then the next thing I was like, what should I do now? And then I thought about, I searched online and then I learned about the GED. You know, my sister sent me books from England and I studied them without looking if there are GEDs in Afghanistan or any near neighboring country. But, you know, after months, I realized that, okay, GED is not in Afghanistan. It's neither in Pakistan. So I have to give up on that. But, you know, I was just, you know, I think learning, I couldn't give up on learning because I was like, if I give up on this thing, what will I be able to stand for? And so then I decided that I'm going to take the IELTS exam, which is an English proficiency exam that my brother took to apply for university. But of course, for him, he had already had a diploma, high school diploma, which I didn't have. And so I started preparing for that exam. And then I was like, oh, maybe I know English, like speak, not my speaking. I have more practice. I need more practice in that. And so I found this online exchange, like online website where you put your language and then you, you know, you find a partner who wants to learn your language and you want to. So this is like a conversation exchange, a language exchange program. And so there I, you know, met Emily, is a like American student. And so we start talking and she was like, how did you learn all of these things? And then from that day, she told me, like, you have to take the SAT if you want to come to the U.S. And so then this was 2015, I started preparing for the SAT exam. Yeah.
And it was not easy for you to take the SAT. Talk about what you had to do just to get yourself to a place where you could take the test.
Yeah, so in Afghanistan, the SAT exam was not available. And so I had to go across, you know, one of the most dangerous border in the world to Pakistan to take the SAT. And somehow I went to Pakistan. But when I went there, I found out that all the seats were full. And I couldn't, this was my only chance. I couldn't just go back and just come, you know, a year later. And so I waited like 2 months. And somehow, like, Emily just kind of knocked on so many doors and the spot for the SAT was opened for me. I took the SAT. I did well. And I applied for colleges in the U.S. I accepted to some. I came back to Afghanistan. And I then applied for a visa to come to the U.S. now that I have been accepted to a university in the U.S., but, you know, when I'm with my mom, I went to Kabul, went to the embassy. But in a 1 minute, that visa officer denied my visa. And when I asked for explanation, he told me, I don't think you're going there to study. You're just immigrating there. So we are not giving you the visa.
Wow. This is not the end of the story, but we'll pause right there and say there was also pressure on you to get married. What made you so sure this wasn't something you wanted, at least at that point in your life?
I think, again, I felt like I wanted to understand the world. I wanted to understand my place in the world. And I think that was the more immediate things that I wanted. I knew what marriage will give you. Marriage, well, you're just going to be, you know, someone else is going to decide what you want. Someone else is going to be, your life is just going to be, I will have less freedom than I had when I was not married. And I just couldn't live with that.
And we should say, I mean, your mother was one of these forces. It sounds like she was a little bit torn, but she felt like it wasn't out of cruelty that she wanted you to marry. She felt like this would be the safest you could be.
Yes. I mean, I think what I was able to do is, I mean, I was so lucky to be able to come the way I wanted to come to the U.S. and study. And so she had seen life, and she knew, you know, what it means when you're not married. And so I think that's what, you know, she wanted, like, you know, you can just marry to someone who is, you know, lives in Europe, like my sister did. And that will give you at least some freedoms that you're looking for.
So, Sola, you've told us about your conversation partner, Emily, who had signed up for this service so that you could chat, you could practice your English. You became friends. It sounds like you told her all about your life. She told you all about hers. How different did you realize your lives were from those conversations you had?
I think at a human level, we didn't feel like it was that much different. But of course, you know, she was living a very different life than I did. And, you know, she was just so extremely, like, so confident that, you know, everything for her was possible. While for me, everything that I wanted, I had to, like, look a thousands ways that it can't be done. And I think I looked at life with more impossibility, and she looked at life with possibilities. And I think that's what, you know, I think it was just her, you know, just living, growing up in America, and just everything is possible was allowed her to help me. Even though, I mean, I don't think at that time she realized how hard it would be, but it just, I think just growing up in America, that you give this a lot of confidence.
So you described to us earlier that you were turned down for a student visa, which is hard to justify, but this is what happened. How did you end up getting a different kind of visa to come study here?
So when I was rejected, you know, I applied again for a student visa. And meanwhile, at that time, I was reading books by, you know, physicists in the U.S. And so Emily connected me to some of them. And so I was talking to them, and they also were in the process when they learned that, okay, I was rejected visa. And so one of them contacted, you know, a journalist at the New York Times. And so he wrote about me, and that's what allowed me to get a humanitarian parole visa, which is just a one way to enter to the U.S. It's just an entry sticker. And so that's how I was able to come to the U.S.
I'm really glad that worked for you. And yet your story makes me think about all the other people who aren't able to come. Not everybody can get this special kind of visa.
Yes. I mean, today I was reading an article about an Afghan woman. She's accepted to Columbia University and New York University, but she's denied like visa. And I think the same reason that they have given me, she's given too. So it's just so devastating that, you know, just not the Taliban that are just crushing you. It's just, you know, countries like U.S., they all talk about freedom and things. But then yet when it comes to Afghans, they just, you know, shut the door in our faces.
Do you remember, did your parents give you any advice when you were preparing to leave home?
They didn't think until I left. I didn't think that I will be able to go, because again, I think when you grow up in Afghanistan, you look at life with impossibilities. And so I think they were shocked when, you know, just one morning I just got a call and said, well, you have to come and bring your passports and, you know, you will get a visa. And so it just was just a few hours. And my father was proud. My mom was very, very emotional when I was leaving. And yeah, it was really hard for her because we just did not know when we were going to Sorry, I'm emotional.
That's okay.
And when we're going to be seeing each other.
Yeah. When you finally moved to the US and you were living in a dorm, you would fantasize that your mom was there in the room with you. You would dream that she was there and then wake up and realize she wasn't.
Yeah, I think I just felt like, you know, just like living in two worlds. And I didn't imagine when I was in Afghanistan, I just felt like, you know, when once I am in school, I'm learning, I think I will never look back in Afghanistan or the people I've left. I'll be so happy in what I'm doing. But when I was finally able to do that, I felt, you know, I mean, it's been 7 years that I haven't seen my family. And so, yeah, every night I would, like, there most of the time that I would dream about my mother, and then I would be so close to hugging her, but only even, and in my dream that I would feel it's a dream, but somehow I wanted to continue that dream to continue, but then I would wake up and she would not be there. Yeah.
So, like, you had learned back when you were living with your parents how to tune out distractions and just focus on your studies, and that was wonderful. It must have been a lot, though, to suddenly be living among a lot of American young women in a college dorm whose sort of standards of behavior were very different from what you were used to. How did you get accustomed to that?
You know, I never in my life had access to so many, you know, books, library, and people, you know, professors. So I tried, I don't think that was the best strategy, but I just like, I wanted to learn so much. So that was all I was focused on, you know. And, you know, I started in Arizona State University, and, you know, there I met, you know, Nobel laureate. And so he encouraged me to study quantum physics. And so that's when I started. And then I met another young professor. She was a research in quantum gravity. And so I started research with her. And so and then I also started falling in love with books like Russian literature, Dostoevsky. And I think that, you know, I just surrounded myself with those things.
What is it you love about quantum physics?
I think, you know, it's just like, I think understanding things, you know, smaller than atom level. And I just kind of making a bigger picture from the smaller things. And I think that's what I love. And it's also, I think, when I was in Afghanistan, I started with philosophy. And if you go back to Greeks and ancient philosophers, they all talk about, you know, they do talk about atoms. They do try to understand the world from the smallest things. So how that became like the bigger world emerges from that. And so I think that's what kind of drawn me into quantum physics and later quantum computing.
And it does sound like your professors, or at least some of them, were immediately interested in you and recognized how much your brain was capable of.
Yeah, I mean, I've been very, very lucky with, you know, people that I felt like, you know, I would not even dream of. I wouldn't, like, they would talk to me, but they're my friends. So I think that's very, very rewarding. And I think that's what, you know, keep me more, like, I think my, it just, I, I'm motivated, I'm continuously motivated, I think, because of the people that I've been surrounded with, whether it was, you know, Frank Wolchek, Nobel laureate at Arizona State University, Cynthia Kaler, or now Peter Love at Tufts University.
So your parents have been through so much over the years. They moved, you know, back and forth into different cities trying to find safety. Your father was not convinced that the U.S. would fully withdraw troops from Afghanistan.
Yes, I think because if you go back to 2001, there were so much promises that were made. And, you know, Afghanistan did change a lot over those 20 years. And so much investment. And again, there was a lot of promises that the U.S. is not going to leave the, you know, Afghanistan and all of that. And so no one thought until, you know, the day the Taliban arrived on the gates of Kabul that, you know, this is going to happen. And people just thought, what about those 20 years?
So how were they finally convinced to try to leave, your parents?
I mean, they tried to leave for us because, we knew, the Taliban rule, we knew it back from the 90s, how dark the rules were, you know, no one can get to the country, no one can get out. And most of my siblings are out of Afghanistan. And, you know, my mom would have never see them again. And so they just wanted to leave for us so that, you know, they can be in a country where we can freely visit them. They can see us.
They were really close, and then something terrible happened.
Yeah, I mean, they went, very bad accident happened that left my mom paralyzed.
So she's eventually, she was able to get a visa to go to Greece to get better care. How is she doing now?
She's the same, and I think, I often think about her and what life could have been for her if, you know, she was not in Afghanistan, she was not born in Afghanistan, or if the civil war didn't happen. And, yeah, I think for me, she represents Afghanistan for me.
I imagine she's very proud of you.
Yeah, but I think looking at her, I forget. Nothing seems like, I just feel like I've lost so much, then everything else is just too small.
Yeah, I mean, nothing would have been different for your parents, for your mother, had you stayed. Do you ever think about how different your life would be if you had not had this extraordinary drive to learn and hadn't left the country when you did?
Yes, I do think a lot, you know, especially, you know, again, you know, Afghanistan, in back to dark ages, you know, when the U.S. troops withdraw, you know, women just disappeared. They were just, Taliban have over 2 years, they're now 50 Ariks that just want to erase women from the society. I do often think about, it just, now my life seems normal, like, okay, I want to do this thing, and then I do it, and like this, and then I think about, like, what if I was in Afghanistan right now, and it's just every small thing that I enjoy, it would, like, life would have been so different, and in some ways, like, the more I grow intellectually, the more I mourn it, because I'm like, how many Afghans women are capable, but yet they're just, you know, restricted by circumstances beyond their control. And I think my mom herself, she has been a very wise and intelligent person. And I often think how much Afghanistan lost, and because of her loss, you know, when she would have given back if the civil war didn't happen, if the Taliban didn't come back, and then it just, she would have given so much back to the country.
There are, you know, you're well adjusted to life in the United States now. You're thriving at work. There are things you missed. You write that you took an instant dislike to American food. Have you been able to find good Afghan restaurants or cook for yourself in ways that taste better to you than hot dogs and Cheetos and whatever it is we eat?
Yeah, I cook for myself, but I think I've learned to, I think there are, you know, the sandwiches, I think it's easy and you can put so many different things. You can be creative with it. So, yeah, I think I've learned to pick up a few things.
Do you think American universities do a good job welcoming students who come from different parts of the world and helping them really adjust? You had your good friend Emily and some professors. I don't know what the support system looks like for every student.
I mean, I can only speak for my experience, and it's been very welcoming. And I think Oh, most of the people that are closest to me are, from university, at Arizona State University. I have a very, like, one of the dean is a very close friend. I talk to her, like, once a week. And Tufts, too, my advisor. And so many people that I know are from, universities. And I just, there's so many, they're intellectual. And so I think they have everything that I look for.
How did you start thinking that you wanted to write your life story?
I mean, I think Afghanistan has been seen mostly journalistic views. And, we hear things about, a bomb explodes or airstrike happens. And it doesn't give you like a window to feel how it feels like to be a person in the situation or a person who is impacted by those things. And so I wanted, my story is about education, but it's about, Afghans' experience in general. And so this was for me like a first step to like open that window so that people can see, it's not just about the extreme situation, but it's also about small things, and I think this universal experience of humans that connect us beyond where we are from. So I think that's what drew me to write my story.
When you want to know what's happening back home in Afghanistan, where do you go for news that you trust, but that maybe will also give you the kind of context that you need?
I mean, I read like New York Times, Washington Post, everything. I just like the first thing that I wake up is Afghanistan news. But then I have relatives in Afghanistan. I talk to them, how do they see, beyond the news, how do they see it? And then I also have my own experience too, even if I'm reading a story on a news article, I could see, what it feels to be behind this, this news. I read a lot, and I think not just about Afghanistan, but just in general, like fictions. And I think it does help me to just, I think, step out from where I am and to feel, or hopefully maybe at some degree, feel what other people are feeling.
You write in the book about a cousin, a boy, who's a few years younger than you, that was inspired by your journey. Where is he now on his quest for education?
He lives in the West. I can say he's in Canada. And before I would talk to him, when he was in Afghanistan, he would talk to me about the bombs that were exploding, the airstrike, and then when the Taliban are coming. So he's just this young person, talking about things that were so, like, adults should talk about. But now that I talk to him, he talks about simple things of life, going out with friends into downtown Toronto, or, talks about debates that he'd been participating in. So I think for me, just like children doing children things, is just so, just calming.
I'm glad that you got a visa to come here, that you're established here, that you're safe. But there are so many ways in which a one-way visa is kind of a cruel thing. As you mentioned, you haven't seen your family in a really long time, at least your parents.
Yeah, I think over the years, especially after Afghanistan fell and, my mom got into an accident. And I think that those years were, it's been really, really hard. You have to disconnect yourself from some of your emotions, because otherwise you're gonna stop living. And I think it is very, it's not humane. Like, it shouldn't be just like, okay, you should be grateful you're not in Afghanistan. This shouldn't be the way it is. I think it should be allowed to, to live as a full human. And when something like that happens, you should be allowed to feel it, and you can only feel it fully when you get allowed to see that person.
So the book is called Defiant Dreams, and this is really about your dream of getting an education. But the thing about dreams is that once we fulfill them, we start to dream about other things. Now that you are established here and working as a quantum researcher, what do you want now?
I want to continue, of course, I'm continuing research, but I'm currently working, I start working on a novel. It's set in Afghanistan, and it's about, especially those 20 years I think if you look, you know, those 20 years kind of created two generations of Afghans, and one was that was more globally connected and educated, but then there's this another part of Afghanistan that was impacted by the air strikes, that the freedom that it brought, the one part were oppression to the second part. And it's about the lives of how they interact and how they meet at the end. So this is what, a novel that I'm currently working on.
Well, I'm really excited for that to come out. Is there anything you're not good at that you try?
I think there's a lot. There's a lot of things that I want to be good at and still not good at.
Well, I have had no indication so far, but I wish you continued success. Sola Mahfouz is the author of the memoir Defiant Dreams, the journey of an Afghan girl who risked everything for education. It was written with co-author Malena Kapoor. Sola, it's been so nice getting to know you. Thank you for sharing your story.
Thank you so much for giving me the chance to share it.
You can find us on Facebook and Instagram and subscribe to our podcast wherever you like to get podcasts, or go to our website to listen. That's think.kera.org. Again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.